Chapter 11, Washington, D.C. This is probably going to be the hardest one to get through. There's so many moving parts. When I left off about getting that job at the House Post Office, the administrative assistant took me down, it wasn't too far down the hall, to the post office, introduced me to Hap Morris, the postmaster. I talked with Hap briefly, and then he sent me into the next room to give all my vitals to his secretary, Jean Jackman. I'll get back to her later. On this job, they put me working with a guy named Dick Jones. Dick had a withered left arm. His elbow always stuck out. But Dick had an interesting history. He called himself Lace Curtain Irish from New York City. He'd been on Wall Street for many years, and he told me that Wall Street, the Christmas bonus would equal your whole year's salary from that prior year. So everything really was weighted at the end there for Christmas. And he made a ton of money and everything, but of course he lost it all when it crashed in 29. At some point in there, he was appointed secretary to the governor of Puerto Rico. So, you know, this guy had been something, but all he was when I knew him was a lush, and I mean a real lush. But Dick showed me the ropes around there in the post office. We had these, I'd say about 6 foot long and maybe about 2.5 feet wide metal tubs with wheels. We were assigned two floors in the office building to deliver mail to. And in this case, it was the 15th and 16th floor of the new house office building. There was just two buildings in that time. And we'd fill it up with mail would come in about three times a day. When we got in there, there'd be mail waiting for us about 8 o'clock in the morning. And then another mail would come in while we're working on the first one. And we would, after we got those two mails put up, we would bundle it up for each office and take it on up the floors and deliver it around there. And you come back at noon, there's another, noon or 1 o'clock, there's another big delivery, and then you take that up and you're done for the day. So actually, when I first started working there, somebody put a stopwatch on those guys that worked on the primary. That's the guys that just broke it down when it came in. And they worked 27 and a half minutes that day. Of course, the pay wasn't that great, you know, but this is a political patronage job on D.C., and it was something else. Well, Dick introduced me to a guy named Joe Warner, who was he developed photos for United Press. And Joe was a heck of a nice guy. He's one of my best friends ever. And Joe introduced me to playing the numbers, you know, and betting on horses, and the book he wrote on Capitol Hill, only about two or three doors down from the House Office Building. There's this long street, probably about two blocks long, just east of the old House Office Building, and down that street, I think there were something like 13 bars and restaurants, and a liquor store, and a drugstore, in which there was the druggist Doc Steinberg was actually a bookie. So you place your bets with Doc. And I didn't do that much too much personally. Joe usually handled all of that. And we played the numbers game. You know, Joe he worked in the United Press building downtown, and then there was a bookie named Muscle who actually had his own desk there at the United Press. Anyway, and through Joe, I got all around D.C. He showed me everything. He was born and raised there. I'd say Joe was probably about in his 30s. He's probably about 10 years older than I was. I was 22. Yeah, he's probably 32 or so. I had to go down with that big tub and go down into the basement and go along a long corridor and go on over to the new house office building. And just shortly after you get off the elevator there in the basement, there's the house photographer's office, a guy named Dev O'Neill. And I'd rumble by Devin. He'd stick his head out the door to see who it was going by. And he, hey, Rod, you want a snort? You know, this would be about 9 o'clock in the morning or something, 10 o'clock. And I said, well, hey, I'll be back, Dev. And I go deliver my mail and then come back and knock on his photographer's door. It was a kind of a black room, dark room. He let me in, and then where it was visible in there, you could see pictures of him and I think just about every Hollywood star who came from overseas, especially. I remember Sophia Loren and Gina Lola Brigida, pictures like that. Dev had them. One further note on Dev, one time he was working late at night, and he was trying to get a candy bar out of the candy machine there in the house, and it wouldn't give him the candy bar, and he went berserk. He went nuts on the machine. Next thing you know, the house cops have him, and they put him in the... They have a two-cell slammer at the bottom of that house office building, and Dev spent the night down there in that. My friend Joe Warner used to work for the Red Cross, and at some point in that 5 years I was there, he got a call from Red Cross if they would come down and help him. They had a backlog of pictures to work on, to develop. And so Joe, it was a Saturday, Joe said, did I want to come along with him? I could run the dryer. I said, yeah. So he showed me how to run the dryer, and he developed them and stuff. And all of these pictures were of Brady's Civil War pics. Amazing pictures. You know, I suppose if you had a few of them now, you might be a rich man. But the Red Cross has them all. There used to be a bus on the right on the corner at the by the first restaurant, just as you came across the side street there at the old house office building. It's the bus that never moved. You could see there was spider webs, you know, and all that stuff that grows on the tires when nothing moves. But there's always people in it. And it turned out that's where a lot of these horse players would sit in there and figure out their bets, and they'd run a few doors up the dock and place the bets with them. Eventually, the cops came and raided the bus. Torque it, took it off one time, dragged it off. One of my favorite characters there was a guy named, we call him Maxie the Taxi. He was a taxi driver, a Jewish guy. He had some of the funniest stories, but in D.C. in those days, you could ride to the district line for a buck. You could go across every zone in the district, I think, for $3. And one time, Brother Dan came to town, and it was an inopportune event. He came at a bad time. I had a date that afternoon when he showed up, so I took him down to Maxie the Taxi and slipped Maxie $5 and said, "Take him around to the monuments, Maxie. Show him the town." So later on, when I saw Dan, I said, "Did you get to the monuments?" "Yeah." I said, "Did you go in?" "Oh no, he just drove by him." I said, "Well, that ain't the same, bub." There's a guy from Chicago named Harry Tanzi. He and his wife were sort of institutions at this one bar, Ted's Mars Bar and Grill, and Harry was really fun to talk to. He was suing the U.S. government for thousands of dollars. I think it was something like $50,000 worth of booze that they had destroyed, that the Untouchables had destroyed in Chicago. When he had this warehouse, he said, that was locked up. He was not dealing in the liquor. When Prohibition came, he just locked all his liquor in his wholesale building. He was waiting for Prohibition to pass. But they didn't think so. They busted into his warehouse and broke every bottle in there. So Harry had this lawsuit. He'd get some Chicago congressman would pick up the baton and carry it along and try to get him his money, but it never happened. I remember Harry came in one time carrying something under his arm. I said, "What do you got, Harry?" He says, "Ah, the wife's out of town." He says, "I got me a corned beef here, man. I'm going to have some real good corned beef and cabbage." A couple of days later, I saw him and said, "Harry, how was that corned beef?" He says, "Ah, hey, Roger, it was awful." He says, "I can't wait for the wife to get back." He used to eat Limburger cheese. He'd sit in the back booth. They made him sit back by the men's room and Mars Bar and Grill. For obvious reasons, eating that Limburger cheese. Character in it, Ted Mars. Actually, Ted took a liking to me. He, for one thing, he gave me some credit for to eat there and drink there. And eventually, he's almost like a second father to me. I worked for him off and on, mostly part time. And occasionally we'd close the place down at night. And there was always a guy hanging in there that, personally, I call Flannel Mouth. He just looked like a froggy-looking kind of guy, sat in this one circular booth, and he just held forth all day long. That guy had no end of the BS. And among the things he said, you know, his brother was the president of the University of North Carolina and blah, blah. You never heard so much BS. Finally, old Flannel Moth dropped dead in there one day, and guess who showed up? His brother, the president of the University of North Carolina. And that made me think, you think all that other BS was right? One time I was working in there one night, tending bar, and it was busy. It was around supper time. And there's a lot of people in there eating and things. The cook in the back, I could look. It was kind of a long, narrow place, and I could look back in the kitchen, and I see smoke pouring out of the kitchen, black smoke. So I hustled back there and asked the cook back there, who was another Greek. He could barely speak English. I said, "What's the smoke?" I looked up. He pointed up, and here, these big pot holders, big metal racks, had bolts up there, and in through the bolt holes was coming smoke. Prior to that, I had looked down the basement, and I couldn't see anything, and then he pointed that out to me. So I trotted out front and told the waitress, "Hey, we're on fire." So she yells, "Fire, fire, fire," and calls the fire department. Everybody cleared out. And we're standing out there on the sidewalk, and and the waitress is yelling, "I know he's up there. I know he's up there." And to the fireman. And I knew who she was talking about. I call him Boston Blackie because he was from Boston. He always wore a black trench coat. I don't know if I ever knew his real name. Anyway, they ran back upstairs again. There's some rooms up there for rent. They ran upstairs and found him behind a door. He'd been wedged in behind a door. They brought him back down there and set him down right in front of me. And stretched him out there and then pushed on his lungs, and black smoke came pouring out of his mouth and nose. He was dead, real dead. Go walking once in a while. We went downtown one time, down in the big, you know, America's Mall, the Washington Mall. And, you know, that's not a retail store mall. It's just a huge grass area. And with the reflecting pool and everything down there. And it's a great place for, there's all kinds of activity going on across from the Smithsonian and whatnot. And here's a guy up on a soapbox with a ugly uniform on, ranting and raving about something. So Joe and I stopped to listen to him for a second or two and then walked off and discussed, you know. The guy was preaching so much hate. His name was... you picked it up in the newspaper the next few days. He showed pictures of him. Had his name George Lincoln Rockwell. He was the founder of the American Nazi Party. And I think about 10 years later, one of his own party members assassinated him. Another one of my best buddies there was a younger guy named Dean Matteo, Dino Matteo. And Dean, I don't think he was 25 years old. Oh, no, he's younger than I was. Probably about 20 years old, and I think he had 8 kids already, and then later on one with his girlfriend. But Dean rode a motorcycle a lot. He used to come on up to the hill he had 2 jobs. He worked with us in the post office early in the morning, and then he worked at a 7-Eleven. First time I ever heard of 7-Eleven was from him during the day. Dean one time invited me to go to a motorcycle race in Virginia. So we went over there, and it was pretty interesting. Pretty rough crowd in a way, though. But still, it was interesting. Got through with the races. He says, well, let's go to the campus. I said, what's that? He says, oh, it's a bar. Actually, it's the Gampus Bar, he says, but everybody calls it the campus. We'll go there and have a beer. I said, okay. We get to this bar somewhere there in Virginia. It's got two entrances, maybe 20 feet apart. And you go down a couple of stairs, and there's this 20-foot bar. And then there's a few more steps down to the dance floor and other booths around the dance floor. So we're in, and then they're working on our first beer, and we hear a roar. Through both doors up front come these motorcycles down to the bar level and on down to the dance floor, and they're doing figure eights or whatever down there on the dance floor. We hadn't even gotten through that first beer, and there was already a fight. Somebody went out through a window, so Dino says, let's get the hell out of here. We left. President Eisenhower, I went to his second inauguration. That must have been in 56. I just had to walk across the street to the plaza in front of the Capitol and stand out there. It was pretty crowded, so I was quite a ways back, but they had speakers up in some of the trees, so I could hear what he said. Anyway, at some time during that second administration, Nikita Khrushchev from Russia was coming to town. So they laid out the route in the paper, you know, where he'd be and where they'd be, Eisenhower and Khrushchev, and they were in a big convertible with the top down. We went down and waited. I forget the name of it. It's a big, broad street down there. Of course, they'd already had welded down the manhole covers in case somebody was going to try to assassinate him. But we're standing right behind a cop. There's quite a few people down there. It's kind of crowded. And I used a stage whisper. I said, okay, Dino, throw the bomb. The cop must have jumped about a foot. A lot of people had a good laugh out of that, but I always felt a little sorry for the cop. And it's a good thing we didn't wait to do it these days. We'd still be sitting in the clink. There used to be a little guy that'd come in a suit, and he'd sit up at the bar at Mars Bar and drink 7-Up. And I would be next to him a lot of times, occasionally sitting there, depending on what shift I was working at the post office. Originally, I worked days, and then I worked the morning on the primary for years. So I'd be off about 8 o'clock in the morning on. And he was from Alaska, and he was trying to get Alaska statehood. And he said, I'm going to be the first governor of Alaska, Rog. He says, how'd you like to have a job? How'd you like to head the highway department, huh? He said, I'll give you a real good job there. And I said, Eddie, for one thing, you aren't even a state yet. And another thing is, I grew up in Freeze Butt, Minnesota. I don't need to go to Freeze Butt, Alaska. I said, I like it was a little warmer. But son of a gun was right. Alaska got statehood, and Eddie Egan was the first governor. Used to work with a couple. Well, a lot of guys were drunks there. But there's two especially. One was, his last name was Hayes, so naturally we call him Gabby Hayes, from an old movie character, you know. And Gabby, he used to come in, we were in the bar in the morning after getting off of working early, having breakfast, and he'd come into the bar and sit there and order a shot of whiskey, and maybe a beer back too. But when the whiskey came, he'd take a handkerchief out of his pocket, he'd twist it up, he'd flip it over his head on his neck, he'd put one hand on the shot glass with the whiskey, he'd have the one end of the handkerchief on that, and then he'd use the other hand to pull that hanky around his neck and bring that shot glass up to his lips so he could drink it. He was shaking so bad. One time I came out of work at the house office building, and he was in the afternoon. And I was about a half a block or a quarter block behind him walking along. I noticed who it was. Next thing, he's staggering so bad, he fell over into the gutter on it wasn't Pennsylvania Avenue, Independence Avenue. And so I went over and he managed to get him up on his feet and helped him. Had to go by another block, though. It was quite a chore to get all the way down to where he lived. But it's a good thing they'd have clapped him in the can for sure for being that drunk. There was a old Marine Master Sergeant named Pat O'Reilly, I think his name was. He was a real character. He was usually loaded. One time around Christmas time, there somebody gives away free eggs, so for eggnogs, over in the house office building. So I'm crossing the street one way, and Pat's crossing the street the other way, and I see him carrying all these eggs, and he slipped. I don't know how many dozen eggs he had on him, but he sure had a lot fewer eggs when he got up off the pavement in the middle of the street. Another one of my favorite drunks was Furman Manzanares. So the Manzanares boys were from New Mexico. Really nice guys. Well, one time we were all drinking all night, and we ended up over at their apartment, and everybody starts falling asleep one by one, you know. And I'm just about asleep in my chair. I look over. Furman's been stretched out on this couch, and smoke starts pouring up out of it. So I bounce up and with my drink and pour it right down that hole. It was right next to his neck, I think, and woke him up in the process. You know, he was kind of lucky. Well, maybe we were all lucky. Another time there was a long corridor that led into the house office, post office, and I was standing near the start of it and at the post office, and I see him coming down the hallway, and he's bouncing both, and these are wide hallways. He's bouncing against both hallways. He's all dressed up, though, dressed to kill. So I walked over to him, turned him around, and I said, well, we'll see you later, Furman. Don't come back. You know, I had lived in a rooming house with, it was owned by an old gal and named Greta and her husband Alex. And they were both foreigners. She was I think German born, and he was Lithuanian, something like that. In fact, he'd been torpedoed by a German U-boat in the Baltic, but he managed to survive that. He was on some sort of merchant ship. Greta used to sit around with a bunch of her friends drinking wine, Viva Vino by Petri. And one time I came home, and they were just pretty well along there, about three or four of them, and I sat down with them. We polished off that bottle of wine by, she says, Hracha, put you go down to the liquor store and get us another bottle of that Viva Vino by Petri. I said, okay, Greta. I went down, it only cost $2. Only about a half a block away to the liquor store, and come back, and we polished that one off too. And she says, "We got to go. Alec, come home soon." And she says, "Everybody out." So, she lived on this on the ground floor. Alex, he had the kitchen, and they had everything down there where he lived was on the basement. And the roomers, we lived up on the second floor. Well, I went upstairs to my room. I just sat down and I heard this clumpity clump, 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 ah, splat. So I ran down the stairs, down to the basement, and there she was flat on the floor. I said, oh, Raja, Raja, lift me up, Raja. I said, yeah, we got to call an ambulance. She says, no. I got to fix Alex's breakfast. I don't want him to know I'm drunk. He'll kill me if I don't fix his supper for him. Says, oh, okay, Greta, you're the boss, you know. The next day I came home from work, and I saw her bedroom doors open. I went over and tapped on it a little bit, and I looked. She says, yes. And I said, Greta, how are you doing? Oh, Racha. She says, I'm just so black and blue all over, I can't even move. One night, Alex asked me if I wanted to have a drink with him down in his basement place down there. I said, yeah. I dropped on down. He pulled out a bottle of whiskey, couple of shot glasses, and he had a round game table down in there. We sat around that, and he was a huge guy, big muscular guy. I forget what he worked at, but he was all muscles, and he had a little dangerous look to his eye type of guy. He'd say something, and I'd start laughing. He says, "Racha, you have a very dirty laugh," like that. I never was totally at ease, but we had a good time together that night. One time, Dean Matteo, my motorcycle buddy, wanted to go out to his place out in Manassas, or Bull Run to some folks, and we'd have a few drinks and go hunting out in the woods there. I said, sure, why not? So we did just that. We walked around in the Bull Run woods. I kept imagining, you know, the Yanks and the Rebs walking through there. We didn't see one living thing. I mean, nothing. Not a bird, a squirrel, or nothing. We had these 22 rifles, a good thing, because I didn't want to shoot anything anyway. But we eventually figured it was time to head home. I don't know where the wife and kids were. I never met them. But now, we're out in the hills of Virginia, and we got to go down to Capitol Hill, and it's raining out. And I get on the back of this motorcycle with them, and we're heading down those old slick streets, those hills. And I got a hold of Dean, you know, for security. And finally he says, "Hey, Raj," he says, "you have to ease up. I can't breathe." I squeezed the death out of him for a dear life. I was sure glad when we got up on Capitol Hill, I got to hop off that thing. Old Dick Jones was a roommate of mine for a while, but wow. This is after I moved into an apartment there above the bar, the La Rosa bar. He was just too much to handle when he was loaded. I remember one time I saw him, and he was drunk on a Friday night. I saw him at Mars Bar and Grill, and he was drunk then. I saw him two nights later on a Sunday night, and he was even drunker and not making any sense at all and had not been to sleep the whole time. That's drinking. I had another roommate named Joe O'Connell. Joe was one handsome dude. He was the son of a Supreme Court justice in Rhode Island. The seventh son of a seventh son, he always used to say, the old Irish thing. He was black-haired, blue-eyed, handsome devil. And Joe, though, he was almost as bad as Dick about drinking. And we both worked the same shift at one time, which was early in the morning. And that guy just could not wake up. I remember one time I threw a bucket of cold water on him. He was laying on a mattress on the floor. And in those days, we had no air conditioning in the summertime in D.C. It was just awful. We did have a fan, a reverse fan. You could either blow in or blow out through the window. So we'd flop on the floor on a mattress on there and try to get some sleep. Anyway, I had to throw a bucket of water on Joe to get him up. He and I one time went to Canada together. I think we had about a week's vacation, something like that. And we went up, I think I went to Connecticut to see Mom and Dad for a little bit, and then went on up to Providence and met up with Joe. And he had one of the family cars, and we drove over to Niagara Falls. Then we went up into Toronto. And somewhere up in there, there's a bar that we stopped at, and we got out of the car and we start walking in the door and we're stopped. And the guy says, "You can't come in here." I said, "How come? This is for couples only. The singles doors are on the other side." I said, "What?" So we walk around the other side and walk in, and we're in a bar with just all nothing but guys. And you could look through a space over in there, and you could see the couple sitting and dancing and everything, having a good time over on their side of that bar. I suppose there's a reason for that, but I don't think you'll find that here in the States. Later on, we ended up in Montreal, and I lost Joe, I think, for about a day. Finally found him in a bar. He could speak French. He'd been in Paris for a while, though the French Canadians used to give him a hard time about his Paris accent. But one time when we got to Quebec, we were staying in this Louis Couture's hotel. I think it was Louis XIV Hotel. That's about how old it was, too. they had an elevator in it, but it was for baggage only. And the elevator worked by displacing sand, poured sand into it and sand out of it to get it to go up and down. And it took about 10 minutes to get the bags to go up one floor, you know, on that system. Anyway, we're sitting down there, and it did have a restaurant. And the next morning, and the waitress comes over and is going to take our order for breakfast. And I look down there, and I see something that's looks like OUEF or something. I said, "Well, I'll have a couple of them wolves." That sent everybody in the pails of laughter, because whatever the word is for eggs, I mispronounced it. Yeah, well, we got we finally managed to get back to Providence in one piece, but we came down through way up Levy, past Quebec, Levy, down through the top of Maine, drove all the way down through Maine to get there. It was a heck of a trip. When Joe and I had an apartment together in D.C., it was a shabby place. It was two floors above the La Rosa restaurant. And I decided one time to try to make something out of it. Keep me out of trouble and beautify the place a little bit. It did took a lot of work. Painting and stuff. And I actually got there's an old guy named French who used to hang around Mars. He was an old retired floor stripper. So I said, "Hey," I asked him, "Frenchie, could you strip this floor for me?" He said, "Sure." And we settled on a price. It was cheap, something, $20 or something. And the day came for him to strip our floor up there. He shows up. I hear this clunk, 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 clunk. All the way up two flights of stairs, he brings this heavy floor sander. Then he's got this real long cord. And on the end of the cord are just two bare wires. He drops them out on one of my windows there in the apartment, and then we go downstairs and outside, and he shoves them down through an open window into the basement of the bar, and then pulls that thing all the way over to a huge panel of electrical boxes, and it's wet down there. He's standing on some board between, he was shaking so bad. I got behind a pillar and peered around every once in a while to take a look at how Frenchie was doing. And he was trying to put those raw wires, you know, into a circuit and then clamp it all together. He finally got it. We went upstairs and he sanded that thing down in a good shape. And then back down the stairs, clunkety clunk clunk with that thing he went. But I tell you, he really earned that $20. And then as soon as I got it all fixed up real nice, I came home one night. And here's Joe sitting there with a nice-looking girl at our so-called dining table there. And he introduced me as Lady So-and-So. You know, Joe's favorite entertainment was put on his tuxedo and go on up on Embassy Row and crash the embassy parties. And I don't think he ever got turned away. He just had that look. He looked like he was somebody's ambassador's son, you know, type of thing. And she's a very nice lady, and I spoke for a while, and then I went out again, I guess. I never did see her again.